scar. No, it couldn't. I felt so happy. I hoped it would. I'd have a scar forever. A scar that came from Kate Moss. Sadly, it didn't leave a mark. I loved how she bit me back, because that put an end to that. Personality-wise, Kate and I exist on very different planes. One night, we were standing on a balcony at the chateau when she said, I want to stay up tonight. Give me a number. 8, I guessed. I had no idea where she was going with this game. She looked at me, expecting me to continue. 4, I supplied. This went on for longer than it should have. Of course, she wanted a phone number for a person. A low-key, high-end connection, weed, or whatever. I was just a run-of-the-mill drunk. I had no such number. Robert and I still crack up about that. Every time I see him, that's the joke. Give me a number. The idea of someone asking me for a number is particularly funny if you consider the fact that I had never done cocaine and I didn't enjoy pot. The one time I tried snorting, it was nothing short of a disaster. It was the night before the Met Gala in 2009, and I was staying at the Carlisle. In the room above mine, there was a gathering. A spring breeze floated through the open balcony doors. At one point, I went in the bathroom, where someone had laid out a single line of white powder. I'd never tried cocaine, or any recreational drugs for that matter, for the simple reason that if I acted as weirdly as I did when I drank, best to abstain from hardcore drugs. But it was a small, wealthy group of icons, and it wasn't a huge amount, so I figured this was the time to do it. It tasted horrible. Unspeakably awful. It was so bad that I had to remove myself from all festivities for the rest of the evening. How do people do this? I wondered. It was easily the worst thing other than a Tic Tac in my youth I put in my nose. It cut a burning trail of bitterness all the way down my throat. My sinuses were on fire. As I made my way back to my hotel room, I didn't feel any type of stoned. Not a lift, not a buzz, nothing at all. I went into my bathroom and opened a tiny bottle of champagne. I drank it, then inexplicably passed out on my bathroom floor. The next thing I knew, I woke up hungover. But this wasn't a typical hangover. It was the lowest I've ever felt in my life. I'm talking teeth chattering, body shaking, illness coupled with overwhelming nausea. It turns out that what I'd taken probably wasn't cocaine at all. It was probably crystal meth. But by this point, it was far too late to do anything about it. Chris McMillan came to nurse me to health, but I was sicker than I'd ever been. I spent the day vomiting, wondering how I would possibly make it through. My face was puffy from throwing up all day. To make matters worse, I had lost most of my hair due to an autoimmune issue. But thankfully, the hair genius, Teddy Charles, put a long fall, like my mother would have worn, on me to disguise it. I pieced myself together enough to make it to the gala, where I gave Anna Wintour a hug in the receiving line. You do not give Anna Wintour a hug. I might even have kissed her on the cheek. It was a serious gaffe. I knew better. But I loved her with deep admiration. I'm expressive. Maybe it's because I was so out of it, or maybe because Ingrid and Carl liked me. I had a momentary lapse in judgment where I thought I could get away with such behavior. But I am fully aware this is not how it's done with Anna Wintour. Thank you, Anna, for being so gracious. I wore a black Marc Jacobs mini dress with Louboutin Kate Stiletto heels that had me in pain. No one took my picture at the event. I was confused. Later, I realized that no one recognized me with fake hair and a swollen face. Or maybe illness rendered me invisible. Luckily, I kept it together. No drunk shenanigans, no further embarrassments. In fact, nothing horrible happened to me that night, except that the only man who spoke to me was Donald Trump. While everyone dispersed to their various cool spots, I was standing, floating where I had sat, lingering at the end. I was next to Corinne Rotfeld, and she said, "Don't worry, I'll take you home." Just then, Donald Trump sidled up to us. The first thing he said to me was, "Wow, amazing hair." I could tell it was genuine. "That hair. You have beautiful hair, really. That is sensational hair. Don't you think so, Melania?" Melania was back 3 paces. She took a step forward, holding her expensive clutch, and politely agreed. Corinne was talking again about rides home, and Donald said, "You need a ride, I'll take you." But I turned him down. I preferred to go with Corinne, of course, because she was the coolest. My brief conversation with Donald Trump is funny to me now, for a couple reasons. The first is that it was a very positive exchange. He really liked my hair. The second is that I was wearing fake hair that night. Of course, I didn't tell him. A bad thing happened. I took up with a new guy, hereafter known as the Monster, who turned out to be toxic in every sense of the word. I actually met him at the chateau the same night I bit Sienna Miller. From the moment he pushed into my scene, everything fell apart. The Monster barged in when I was particularly vulnerable. I was making a real effort to go out and make friends again. But unfortunately, that often went hand in hand with drinking. The MS hit me really hard at this point, but I didn't yet understand what it was. I let go of my nutrition, too shut down to digest. I was smoking, I was drinking, and all of it was affecting my looks. My personal life was disintegrating. Emotionally, I was in the perfect position to fall for a toxic person, a fact he instantly got. I wasn't even into him, but he was persistent, quite possibly the most persistent suitor I've ever encountered. People warned me about this guy. My dear Quinn, a newly made close friend, warned me he was a con man, not to be trusted. He was just after the spotlight. He only wanted his picture taken. But he wormed his way into my life. He was, quite literally, all about appearances. He hung around the chateau, leaving a trail of heavy cologne in his wake. He wore colored contact lenses, but denied it. His self-tanner left brown spots on the white bathroom walls. As soon as we started seeing each other, paparazzi appeared in places they had never been. They kept turning up at the dog park, not on Robertson Boulevard, where it's expected. It became apparent afterward that he was the one calling them. When I went away to work, he set up camp at my house uninvited. He looked through my journals, read my private thoughts. When he found something, some fact that he could use to his advantage, he stayed silent. He never divulged that he knew. He uncovered every weakness, cataloging them for later use, to bribe and extort me. As if that weren't bad enough, he remained in my home, living there while I was gone. I was on the other side of the world, and I couldn't get him out. He became vicious. If we disagreed, he would turn on a dime. He spouted nonsensical things, telling stories that never happened, and saying things that weren't true about people I happened to know. At first, I thought he was gaslighting me, but it seemed as though he truly believed them himself. I didn't know how much a person could scare me until I met him. When it became clearer, I tried to extricate myself. This was that time, that Juicy Couture tracksuit moment, when the internet exploded. Gossip websites like Perez Hilton and PopSugar were hugely popular, and they began posting awful things about me, prompted by his insider machinations. One site, The Evil Beat, was the worst of all. I was late to the internet gossip thing, but while I was shooting Hellboy 2, I became acquainted with a computer and discovered that you could search for your own name and a slew of information would pop up. That was the first time I ever Googled myself, and it just about undid me. I was already not in a great place, and that put me firmly over the edge. Back in LA, the Monster posted lies all over the internet. That I was crazy, that I did drugs. He changed my Wikipedia page to include his vicious untruths. I tried to defend myself, taking it upon myself to call these bloggers and explain the situation. But there was only so much I could do, It's not that I was some highly credible character. There were already stories out there about me biting people. It continued this way for a year. Eventually, investigators I hired went to his home and told him how the evidence was traced to his router in LA, as well as to his parents' home in the Midwest. I had already blocked him, but so much damage had been done. The first few years I spent regaining my balance after the divorce were an awful, awful time. A funhouse mirror of bad experiences. I felt totally lost. I would stay in my house, trying to will myself not to drink. My life was messy, ugly, unfocused. I was lonely, I was puffy and hot, I was tired. Always, always tired. I couldn't keep it together. In my attempts to self-medicate, my drinking grew heavier as my mind grew less and less focused. After another bad binge, Troy contacted a rehab specialist who got me into Promises in Malibu. I didn't trust that I could get better being alone in my home. Though my insurance would have covered it, I paid for it in cash, too afraid someone might find out. As with all my stints in rehab, I tried as best I could to keep it to myself. I didn't want to be labeled as either an addict or a depressive because I worried the stigma could impact my ability to get work. It was all a humiliating weakness. I didn't tell anyone, only Troy and a couple close friends. I was in a state of constant terror. As it turned out, the biggest star in the universe, Britney Spears, was also recuperating there. I loved her right away, recognizing she was incredibly dear. At the time, she had a shaved head and wore a cheap platinum bob wig. After we became friends, I suggested she ditch it. I took her wig and told her that she couldn't wear it anymore. It was associated with the crazy label, this tumultuous time in her life, and she was ready for the next chapter, I thought, and told her. May the record stand, I did not steal it, though I did ask her for it, and she gave it to me. I held on to Britney's wig because I wanted to protect her. I told her she was beautiful, and she really, really was. She was so gimmeen and young, but in a horrible situation. She also wore wedged flip-flops. You could hear her coming and going from rooms away. Since she asked me what I bought, what I wore, how I knew what to do, I felt she wanted advice. So I secretly dropped the worn sandals in the trash, hoping it might inspire her to get some real shoes. Instead, she found them in the garbage minutes later and was hurt. "Who threw away my flip-flops?" she cried. I never told her it was me. I thought I was being helpful. I've since come to feel terrible about this. Here was the biggest pop star in the world, in the middle of managing her own public and personal crisis, which her family trapped her in, and I'm throwing away her flip-flops? I meant well. I was just being a girl, not yet a woman. Brittany, I want you to know I'm sorry I threw your flip-flops in the trash. She was an angel, with wisdom and sweetness in equal measure. I had no real idea of the extent of her suffering. I still have her blonde wig. It lives in my closet, in its own little time capsule, a relic of a bygone era. I truly love that girl. We didn't keep in touch. Her number changed a week after she left. Family. After my trip to hell with the monster, I resigned myself to being alone. I was working long hours on the set of Kath and Kim, weary and bloated from eating Doritos and Cinnabon rolls on film as my lazy, snack-driven character. I was juggling both a TV show and press for Hellboy 2, which made it easier to distract myself with work and promotion. We traveled through Mexico with Guillermo and the main cast for a pampered while. My makeup artist, Rachel Goodwin, and I sampled mezcal worm tacos at the Four Seasons in Mexico City, with Guillermo explaining how he dreamed about these tacos. Soft white worms, delicately seasoned. I couldn't swallow the bite, my American brain stubborn as ever. There were long, jubilant nights at candlelit tables in Berlin and Madrid. Laughter and stories, from our cherished director himself. Well-deserved hangovers, along with somber and reverential visits to the Holocaust and Anne Frank museums. My best friend at the time, my dear Quinn, traveled with us and delighted in it as much as I did, even finishing a shallow dish of soup with a baby bird presented in the center. At the chicest, gastronomically superior, six-table restaurant in the Spanish city. When pressed, Quinn appreciatively told the table that the bird was soft, the beak and bones only slightly crunchy. I closed my eyes and had a sip of cold water, and we smiled as we strolled the streets afterward, all spiffy and high-heeled was I. When the festivities ended, I headed back to LA. Months passed. In short order, a girlfriend set me up on a date with Jason Blyke, the designer of a clothing brand I admired called Ever. I had a sweatshirt, the logo of a leaf on the right arm. Jason was quiet and reserved, muscular and gentle, with piercing eyes that were impossibly clear and blue, like a Siberian husky's. I thought he was handsome and sexy, but we didn't connect instantly. He lived in a giant teepee in Topanga, where we had our first date. When I arrived at his little compound, he had candles lit. They twinkled in the tiny tiled bathroom in his studio there, and a beautiful hinoki-scented one danced in its flame atop a large stack of Rizzoli art books. The effect was lovely. The smell of a familiar fig candle Victoria Beckham had been burning on a few visits to her stunning house was gently wafting among his sketch pads and leather samples. I also noticed he was nervous. I actually tried to cancel the date because I'd crushed my left hand earlier that day from a forceful horse kick while out galloping in the hills of Sunland with another friend. But instead, Jason sent a car for me. I was charmed by his thoughtfulness. We walked to dinner at the Inn of the Seventh Ray, and as we ate in relative quiet outdoors that evening, with twinkle lights all around, he cut my food because I couldn't use my knife. I noticed he was strong, with good taste, a good eye, a special kind of man. But he was reserved. Also, intriguing. I couldn't get a real read on him. After dinner, we went back to the teepee, with its wood-burning stove in the center. We casually lay down on the bed, each staring up, nestled among the fur blankets. It wasn't romantic as much as it was just being present. At one point, a spider quickly spun down from a beam of the teepee, heading for my face. I rolled over, pressing into his side. It was just a reaction, but he rolled away. I was sensitive, and it hurt my feelings. "Well," I said, "I guess it's time to go." The car arrived. We said goodbye. We shared an awkward hug. The whole interaction felt platonic, confusing. I left, bemused and fine. I didn't expect to hear from him again. A week later, he sent a text. "When can I see you again?" It was funny to me. And now I was curious. Why would he want to spend more time in my company? I didn't know him, how reserved he was in new situations especially, though I would come to understand he is a man of few words. He arranged to pick me up to go to an art gallery. M&S was the name of it. A small, cool space with an exhibit by a great artist who does pool photos and oceans. Not Slim, someone else, but someone great. He was visibly nervous. He didn't speak much in the car. His speech seemed kind of clipped, quiet. So I talked a lot, as I do. "I like this song." It was Jay-Z and Alicia Keys, Empire State of Mind. "You know, I stopped listening to anything, but I like that you do. Listen to music." Silence. He smiled and got us to the space. I was amused. I didn't know what to make of it. When we pulled up to the gallery, it was closed. He had the date wrong. He was stricken, mortified, stunned. I laughed and said, "Don't worry, let's get a coffee." Coffee turned into dinner at Pache in Laurel Canyon. We sat in a cozy booth in the farthest corner. At some point, he took my hand and held it. I held his hand back. When he dropped me off at home, I went inside and cried. I felt inexplicably forlorn, and I kept thinking of his hand holding mine at the table. I knew. I just knew we were connected until the end. And I felt hard times in it. On our first day date, he took me paddleboarding at Topanga Beach. He drove us to the Malibu Country Mart on a rich-looking, customized black BMW bike. We wound around the late afternoon canyon sun to get there, both wearing ever-leather jackets. We held hands, already in love. For the first time in my adult life, I felt I had a man on my arm who was suitable for me. I smiled and leaned in as the ever-present paparazzi snapped a few photos as we strolled. Earlier, I took a picture of him unstrapping the boards from the top of his Mercedes G-Wagon. I sent it to Troy, who approved. And so, we were a couple. My heart grew full and in love. I found him fascinating and specific, passionate about Dan Eldon and his family, about fonts and branding. His hands were handsome and strong, with long nail beds, which my mother and I always favored. We were mad about each other. He thoughtfully customized my riding helmets, making leather bands to go around the sun-soaked velvet, complete with my initials embossed by him. Loving gestures, to say the least. I gave him my soft cotton hanky to use for his allergies when we drove up to ride my horse Dark. I loved the way he slowly walked with a coffee in his hand. Pleased to be doing just that. He liked real cinnamon sticks in his coffee. He once told me that was all he needed from me. Cinnamon sticks in his coffee. Turns out that wasn't true. Or maybe it was, and I was the one who was after something more. I still have jars of cinnamon sticks, waiting to be plunked in his Dark brew. Soon after, he left to go on a trek with his best friend Scooter, visiting ancient monasteries in Tibet, while I flew to New York to shoot another movie, Dark Horse, with Todd Solondz. The film was a major win for me, an honor, Todd being my favorite director to work with, and knowing my mother would be pleased. "Happiness is pitch perfect," my mother would announce. "Perfect!" We were in wholehearted agreement that Todd Solondz was our personal story hero. Mom couldn't make it in the winter to visit, but Jason came to visit me twice. Todd liked him. He was likable, a good man. Like a hopeful teenage girl, I scrawled Jason's name all over my notebooks. I wrote his name over and over on the soles of my Converse, along with the word ever. I was smitten. On October 13th, 2010, he flew from Nepal to New York to be with me. It was the first time we'd been together in several months. I was staying at the Standard Hotel in the Meatpacking District, my friend Andre's hotel, and ran downstairs to greet him. We had the most healing and enduring hug that I've ever had in my life. I was so overwhelmed with gratitude and love, I could barely catch my breath. In love. In hope. Miraculous. A fellow guest at the hotel, laying eyes on the two of us, reunited, and in the elevator, going back up to our room, said, "You're both so beautiful. Look at that happiness." It was truth. That night, our son Arthur came into existence. It was a perfect night. I wasn't impulsive or lost. I was there, fully present. Everything about that moment was very loving. We were safe and didn't have any idea a baby was in the cards. When I found out I was pregnant 6 weeks later, all I could think was how desperately I wanted this baby to be safe. I wanted him with all my heart, whatever that meant. The tide of my life was turning toward a new North Star. Every decision I made, every stumble and success brought me to this moment. Arthur was growing inside me. A miracle, a reason. Oceans upon oceans of love swelled inside me even before I saw his face. Part 3. Answers. Motherhood. Through all the messages and predictions I'd heard in my life, from all the mystics and healers and energy workers, there was always a common refrain. They all noted I had a darkness around me. Early in my pregnancy, I drove to Woodland Hills to see a man named Kit. He had more of a pedigree than I was used to. Apparently, he read for presidents. I hoped this time might be different. "You'll have a hard time with the baby's father," he told me. "You won't stay together." I didn't have any intention of being a single mother. But I also think Jason and I knew that it probably wouldn't last. "You and your son will be inseparable until he's three, at which point he'll be closer to his dad also." He paused before continuing. "Whew, you will go through a very hard time. You've gone through a hard time already, and you will be tested for the next 10 years. "Oh," he called it all. Another seer, Bobby, said, "This kid's going to take everything from you. You will live in that moment between the lightning and the thunderstorm. And in the end, you will not be afraid." He told me I needed to keep the circulation going in the spot where my brainstem meets my neck. As it turns out, that is my problem area, the place where I have the most damage. Right before Arthur was born, I went to see Kit again. He told me that in Arthur's last life, he was an Irish fisherman with an anchor tattoo. Maybe it's pure coincidence, but now Arthur's biggest passions in life are deep sea fishing and swearing like a sailor. The truth is, I was scared to death to have a child. I knew I had love to give, but otherwise I felt ill-equipped. I was afraid of how much help would cost. I was afraid of how I'd adjust, because I'm such a loner. Other pregnant people would touch their bellies and smile, proclaiming, "I don't care if it's a boy or a girl, I just hope it's healthy." My version of that was, "I don't care if it's a boy or a girl, just let it be a puppy." Until I got pregnant, I was never someone who dreamed of having a child, so I thought maybe, just maybe, the doctor would pronounce it a puppy. My only dependent up to that point had been Wink, my precious rescue dog. Even my mother was skeptical of this unexpected turn in my life story. "This is awful, Selma," she moaned when I told her the news over the phone. "How will you work?" She was afraid for my career. I'm sure it also brought up memories of the hardships she had experienced during her own single motherhood and how strong she had to be, going to law school in the midst of it. My pregnancy was bookended by destabilizing pain and bladder and kidney infections. But the rest of it was magical. The truth was, I'd never felt better. What I know now is that pregnancy can put MS into remission. It was amazing. I had energy, clarity, hope. I ate well. I didn't touch alcohol. It was, for many reasons, the happiest time I'd ever experienced up to that point. All my life, I'd always felt most comfortable dressed in black. It was my wardrobe staple. But now I was so blissed out that I started wearing pastels. In multiple magazine interviews about my pregnancy, I'm quoted as saying, "I am just too happy to wear black." I was photographed looking healthy in white sundresses and wedge heels. Jason and I went down to Mexico for a baby moon. It was such a joy to be sober, back in the water, and to feel safe, bobbing up and down like a seal, feeling the large waves lift me up and down. I was photographed in a tiny bikini, my belly a watermelon, my entire face a smile. I loved my obstetrician, but I'd watched Ricky Lake's documentary, The Business of Being Born, and felt inspired to have a home birth with a midwife and a doula. I wanted my son to work his way here. I wanted him to come in comfortable, prepared. More than anything, I didn't want to repeat my mother's scheduled C-sections, her rigid birth schedule. For me, childbirth would not be a chore. I wanted this baby with every ounce of myself. When I was in the second trimester of my pregnancy, at what was otherwise one of the healthiest and happiest times of my life, Wink suddenly fell ill. She lay on the floor at the foot of the bed all morning and didn't move, her spirit subdued. "This is the end," I said to Jason. He said she would be okay, try not to worry. But I was worried. That afternoon, I took her to the vet, and they decided to keep her for observation. A few days later, the vet called to say she'd blown a clot. They were keeping her alive so I could come and say goodbye. "You need to come now," they said. When they gave her the shot to end her suffering, I held her against my pregnant belly and wheeled her back to me. I prayed harder than I ever had, but she was gone. A wall of pain surrounded me as they wrapped her up so I could take her home. Other than Bradley, losing Wink was my biggest loss up to that point. I could barely breathe. They'd even died on the same day, February 7th. I still feel a bone-deep pang on that date every year, my body remembering. Jason dug a hole in our backyard. I wrapped her in my forest green monogram towel, a graduation gift from Cranbrook. I set her little head against the embroidered letters of my name and gently placed her in the ground, cursing and blessing God for taking her from me now when I still needed her. A month past my due date, Arthur showed no signs of budging. The midwife had no choice but to let me go. When I went for that last scan, my obstetrician said I'd gone too long and needed to be induced right away. It was evening by that point, and I hadn't slept in days. The Pitocin took a terrible toll on me, but still I refused a cesarean or even an epidural. 37 hours of labor later, Julie rushed home early from a vacation to sit with me. She rubbed my head and encouraged me to get an epidural. "I'm scared. I don't know how to be a good mother," I said. "It doesn't matter if you don't know how to be a good mother," she told me over and over. "You just have to want to be good enough." Finally, she persuaded me to get the epidural, which only worked on half my body. I'd never felt such asymmetrical pain. Another epidural followed. I wasn't dilating enough. The baby was in distress. And then I pushed. His head came out. My body finally realized he was ready and let him go. I reached down and pulled him from me and placed him on my pelvis. When Jason first caught sight of him, he yelled, "Wow, he looks exactly like you. This is crazy." I placed my handsome baby on my stomach because I wanted him to find his own way to me. Everyone in the hospital room watched as he slowly started his army crawl to my right breast. I'd heard of this phenomenon, but I couldn't believe it until I saw it happen with my own eyes. I couldn't believe my damaged body, my enemy for so much of my life, had done this one good, heroic thing. I still can't believe it. Giving birth to a baby, even in the best of circumstances, is nothing short of miraculous. He latched onto my breast, where he drew out the colostrum and fell asleep. Even Julie, who'd given birth 4 times by then, had never witnessed a baby do this. From his first moments on Earth, we were all very impressed with Arthur St. Blyke. As I held him to me, I thought of Wink and thanked her over and over again. "Thank you for getting me to this place, sweet girl. I wouldn't be here without you." That first night in the hospital, Arthur slept. "What an easy baby," I thought. Once again, he had other plans. Arthur was anything but an easy baby, and I was not at ease. I was stiff and weak. Everyone assured me this was normal. It was my body normalizing. This was all normal, normal, normal. But I felt as if something were terribly wrong. From the first instant I saw him, I loved Arthur more than I could ever dream of loving anyone. But when I got home from the hospital, everything hit me at once. I was not well, and I would not be well for many years to come. I was broken. I was exhausted to the point where I couldn't see straight. I'd gone through periods like this before, but now I had a child to care for, and it just felt completely overwhelming. I'd never planned on having a baby of my own, and now, at home, with this tiny creature, the buyer's remorse was brutal. I was woefully unequipped. Early on, I called a craniosacral postpartum specialist. I explained through sobs that my pain was too impractical. Tears led to further exhaustion and dehydration, but I was too deep in it to care. I couldn't stop crying. "I don't like any of it," I said. "Eating my encapsulated freeze-dried placenta hasn't helped for shit." She worked on me. She was patient. She listened. She advised healthy fats and restorative rest. Before I had a baby, I had been able to check out whenever my body betrayed me or made things hard. Back then, I had solitude. I had Tanqueray. I knew how to numb the pain and disappear out of myself. Suddenly, I was hit with a terrible realization. Now that I was a mother, I would never be able to check out again. The nanny I hired for Arthur had worked for me for only 2 weeks when I decided I had to let her go. I needed a live-in. She didn't want to be a live-in. I paid her severance. We agreed to part ways amicably, or so I thought. A few days later, Star Magazine called Troy to say that a former nanny was calling to sell a story about me. Of course, I knew who it was. I paid $5,000 to quash the story. A year later, when she had a child of her own, she sent me an email saying her boyfriend at the time persuaded her to do it as revenge for firing her. She said she was so sorry. "We figured you were rich. I am so, so sorry." I wrote back, "I understand." From the moment I gave birth, pain blossomed throughout my body in ways that were both familiar and entirely new to me. Every joint, every muscle grew stiff and brittle. My neck and shoulders spasmed. I couldn't walk to the bathroom. I couldn't get out of bed. The doctor explained how every woman who gives birth feels this. The ligaments just needed time to adjust, I was told. I believed this. I accepted it. My eyes were red and irritated. My skin broke out. My mind broke down. It was hellish. And it felt as if there were no way out. All I could feel was exhaustion. Arthur cried and cried and cried. No matter what we did, he cried. Unless he got exactly what he wanted, he cried. I was flailing and felt like a failure. I wanted to die, but I couldn't die because I didn't want to leave Arthur motherless. I went into survival mode. I had room in my life for only one other person, and that was Arthur. I didn't have room for Jason. I lacked life force. So I prioritized, I thought. My sense of smell was still so extreme I couldn't stand myself if left unshowered for a day. Needless to say, Jason took the brunt of this because I couldn't take his smell either, which is undetectable to other noses. Jason drifted, and I did too. Our love vanished, replaced with a new feeling that was just as overwhelming. I wished a city bus would run him over. He felt the same way about me. So afraid were we both we would lose precious time with baby. Jason had his house. It didn't make sense for both of us to go unrested, I said. He started sleeping in his house more and more and came every morning before work to have coffee and sun time. We said goodbye, both of us knowing that though we would no longer be together, we would both raise Arthur. Somehow. When Arthur was born, I prayed he'd latch on to nurse right away, and a big part of my job would be done. I'd be a mother. To this, I warn, be careful what you wish for. From the moment Arthur arrived, he only wanted to nurse. He was relentless. He nursed as he slept. He wanted everything, sucking the marrow from my bones. He once nursed for 12 hours straight on a flight to Venice. I was drowning. When I nursed, I never felt the oxytocin, sense of calm that some women experience. I could never sleep, knowing he was going to wake up and need me. When Arthur was a toddler, I hired a woman to help me be a better parent. She asked him what his favorite food was, and he said, "Boob soup." The woman turned to me and said, "Aw, you've got a great kid. He's cool. He'll be fine." Then she taught me about boundaries. I told him, "I don't want you to have a girlfriend while you still recall nursing." Without missing a beat, he replied, "Why you always gotta be so stressy?" He no longer latches on. He's 10, though. Once, in an effort to establish said boundaries, I went into the bathroom to change. "Mama, what are you doing?" Arthur said. "I just need some privacy, Arthur. Sometimes I need time to myself." He replied without missing a beat, "Mama, don't be embarrassed of your itty-witty boobies. I think they're cute." My son looked like an angel, but his lion child tendencies were strong. His roar was not characteristic of our family laugh. It was and still is deafening, demanding. Once I told him he would have to wait. His heel indented in the stairway wall, a kick of rage because he was not immediately placated. Waiting for him to calm down, I scrambled him eggs. He smiled and placed the buttery cooked yolks in my morning coffee with a shit-eating grin. "In Mama's coffee?" he asked, sweetly, curiously. I roared and kissed him. My very own to love, my little saint. I decided I needed to break some of my bad habits in order to give Arthur a shot at a happy, normal life. First and foremost, I wanted him to have a healthy relationship with food. It's taken me until writing this book to realize how malnourished I've always been. I don't have a goal weight. I don't get on the scale. I don't limit myself. I don't have an active eating disorder. But clinically, I have anorexia, because for years and years I didn't eat. My mother was the same way. For her, thin was the only way. On a weekend, if we were home, she would say, "Cut yourself an apple and a piece of cheese." And that was enough, even though it was never enough. When I was younger, I didn't eat because I had a nervous stomach, or I wanted to disappear or stave off puberty. Now I don't eat because my MS makes it both too hard to cut things and too easy to choke on them after I do. In some ways, learning to feed myself has been my greatest teacher, because I needed to see that the way to get the most out of life, out of this body I've been given, is through real nourishment. I never had the patience to make something for myself. On some level, I believed I was not worth the effort. Plus, every time I turned on the oven, I thought of Sylvia Plath. I have lived a whole lifetime not feeding myself properly. Ugh, there's no secret here. I write it because I need to admit it to myself. I wanted Arthur to have the opposite experience. I wanted him to associate his mother with nourishment. Shortly after I bought our house in Studio City, I planted rows and rows of leafy greens that grew wild and spicy in the sun-soaked garden. When Arthur was just a year old and exploring the backyard, I would wander to the greens, romaine, chard, butter, and arugula, and snap off what the earth had made. Exhausted from nursing through the night, I would whimper as I brought a jagged piece of arugula to my mouth with bees hovering by the flowers. I stood hunched and ate, slowly chewing until I had no choice but to swallow. When I brought Arthur over to try some, he screwed up his face and announced, "Too spicy." I thought so too, hot and peppery. I shoved leaf after leaf into my mouth. It was all I could eat that first year. I was like that character from Into the Woods. Greens, greens, nothing but greens. Bitter greens, mustardy and hot. At the table, when I set down Arthur's much-preferred butter lettuce with olive oil and lemon juice drizzled throughout, I gently told him it was okay to eat with his little hands. I didn't mind. Eat, eat, I said. I only wanted him to eat some food. Natural, wholesome food. I pureed yams and peas, butternut squash, and strawberries mixed with sour cream and honey, macerated into a delicious kind of sweet stew. Meatballs made from bison and a marinara sauce his godmother Julie always made. Eggs and butter. Warm croissants from the local bakery owned by two Russian women. He shook his head and walked to me, his toddler arms out like Frankenstein's monster. Nurse! That is all he wanted. He wanted every vitamin and mineral from my own bones, and I gave it to him. The only thing my body did well all on its own. His needy body groped until it settled into the soft flesh of my full breasts. The plates full of tiny portions cut up for a tiny mouth sat in the sink while we nursed upstairs, tears falling from my swollen eyes. One weekend, his dad took him for visitation. Seeing Arthur go always left me empty and in terror. I nagged his father about a toy knife or a screwdriver I saw in my son's grip in a photo text he sent. Nervous, I asked him to be careful. He was too young to hold such a weapon. He was too young to sleep away from his mother. I thought, but could not say. I could only pick apart safety hazards. One Sunday, his father reported how Arthur ate his salad with his fingers. I think he got that from you, he said. I could see he was embarrassed. He was right. I eat salad with my hands, dipping each piece into just the right amount of olive oil. At least he eats, I wanted to say, but I bit my tongue. Back at home, I watched as Arthur picked up each damp green leaf of lettuce from the garden and dipped it into the small bowl of wishbone Italian dressing he favors, which I had carefully placed next to him. He took a whole folded leaf and stuffed it into his perfect little mouth. Some oil smeared on his chin. He went in for another, his bitten nails just skimming the flavored oil when he dipped. He was eating. He was happy. This small boy was so different from the fearful, sensitive girl I was, trying to impress my family, trying to understand the rules, hiding under the bed in shame. He was the complete opposite of me, in fact. Arthur didn't care. He made his own rules. He doesn't fit under any of the beds in this house, and he would never try to, unless to scare you, naturally. When Arthur was 6 months old, I knew I needed to bring in an income, so I landed a job. But he had no intention of giving up nursing. One night during a terrible thunderstorm, I tried to make him wait, and he started what I thought was breath holding. After a few moments, he turned the color of the kitchen counter when the lights were off, rigid and unresponsive and gray. I ran to the door, Arthur cradled in my arms, not knowing what to do. The phones were down from the lightning. I couldn't call anyone. I couldn't reach out for help. The thought that kept repeating in my mind was, what will I tell his father? I put him down on the ground, his body so gray on the glossy white floor, and started CPR as I'd learned in infant CPR class. 30 pushes, 2 breaths. 30 pushes, 2 breaths. His body was as stiff and rubbery as the dummy I'd learned on. It wasn't working. He wasn't coming back. I held him with my right hand, trying to keep his head down so his brain wouldn't lose what oxygen was there. I swung open the bedroom door and raced outside. I ripped his clothes off, hoping the cold would shock him. Nothing. I placed him carefully on the ground and started CPR again. I screamed to God so loud that there wasn't even any sound. Please save him. The rain landed on his eyes. He didn't flinch. I started CPR again, and this time he brought his eyes back to me and smiled. I brought him to my breast, and he latched and nursed. He drank almost as if he were unconscious. Back inside, I held him all night long, praying he would be okay. In the morning, the sun came out. I called Jason and told him what had happened. As I said the words, it felt almost as if it hadn't been real. 6 months later, it happened again. This time, Jason witnessed it. Anytime I tried to make him wait to nurse or to pry something out of his little baby hands, he would hold his breath and turn gray and collapse. I would do CPR, and he'd come back. With each month that he got older, it happened again and again. I devoted all my time to trying to heal him. By the time he was 3 and a half, his pediatrician was out of possible answers. No one could find what was wrong. Finally, a diagnosis: reflex asystolic syncope, a nervous system issue. When the human body goes into fight or flight, it releases adrenaline. The nervous system is what regulates that adrenaline. But Arthur's nervous system didn't regulate. Instead, it shut down all the adrenaline, which in turn shut down his heart. His heart actually stopped beating. He really took playing possum too far. When he was little and had these episodes, I nursed him. Even after he stopped breastfeeding, I needed to feel his body close to mine. It was the thing that seemed to regulate him the most. The attacks continued until he was 6. It happened at a mall in Topanga, with dozens of terrified parents looking on. It happened when Arthur was doing ninja moves in the living room while I sat near him making stencils. That time, his whole body sucked in like a paper bag. He looked so different. It was the most violent episode he'd ever had. In between doing CPR, I called Jason and said, "Get over here, I don't think Arthur's going to live." I called 911. By the time they arrived, I had gotten him breathing again. I threw the stencils away. I recently started taking him on roller coaster rides, so if it happens then, with me, I could help him. I'm terrified it will happen when he's alone or with a friend who can't help him. I've done everything I can to expose him to adrenaline, like immersion therapy. Once, I showed him a snake on Animal Planet. I was curious if it would trigger him when the snake bit a man on screen. "Do we need to turn it off?" I asked. We were lying down. "No," he continued watching this grisly scene, while I kept watch over him, studying him. He looked weird. He went gray. I got him down off the bed and did CPR until he came to. We've never watched Animal Planet again. Anyone who cares for Arthur now knows that he needs to keep his head down. The doctor said he'll grow out of it. He should be able to recover on his own. The last time it happened, my assistant, Bonnie, was in the kitchen, and Arthur was going to the door to wave goodbye. He must have hit his hip. There was no blood. He came up to me, pale and clammy, and reached for my hand. As he held it, he said, "Mom, it's happening." It was the first time he'd ever identified it himself. I had a fire going. I laid him down by the warm flames. I started CPR. The area around his mouth was already tinged with dark blue. I heard a gurgling, but I also felt how hot he was. I screamed for Bonnie to help me. She stayed calm, because she's a pro in all situations. "Keep his head down, grab his feet." I did CPR again, and he came too. I once read about a girl who had this condition, who died at age 15. She was hit in the head with a softball, but she didn't die of the injury. She died from the seizure that followed. I think of her all the time. Split screen. When I look back on Arthur's early years, I see the images play out on a split screen. On the one side, there's me with my gorgeous, sparkly-eyed, adventurous, and curious boy, exploring the bright world together in an Instagram filter of pure joy. And that is all true. We had many, many happy times. Every day with him has a bit of magic to it. He's such a vibrant kid. Being with him requires me to be so present, I almost can't focus on my own body. But on the other side, there's me in a filter of gray. I am stumbling. Throughout Arthur's early childhood, I was off more often than I was on. I now know these were MS flares. I'd fall down our carpeted stairs, My legs would give way for no reason. I felt confused much of the time, exhausted. I would make a pot of coffee, and instead of pouring it into a mug, I'd pour it down the drain. My face grew puffy. I had boils. I'd wake up on weekends with a new cut on my back, not remembering how I'd gotten it. I had to pee constantly. I thought I was stressed, battle-scarred. I thought I'd brought this on myself. Jason thought I was drinking again. I promised him I wasn't. I swore I wasn't. I was sober then, mostly. Occasionally, when Arthur was with Jason, I'd allow myself an airplane-sized bottle of tequila, dipping my toe back into the pleasures of disappearing for only a little while, of erasing the pain and numbing the discombobulation. But I wasn't drinking the way I had when I was younger. I was trying so very hard to be a good mother. Something else was going on inside me. I could feel it growing and spreading. But I had no idea what it was. Elliot again. When Arthur was a year and a half, I decided I needed to make amends with my father and introduce him to my son. It felt wrong to me that he'd never met his grandfather. I hoped seeing my beautiful son would help us start anew. Elliot had been trying to reconcile. He had sent me some money, for which I was grateful. He was trying. I wanted to reciprocate. He was in his early 80s by then and in poor health with a failing heart. I made plans to visit him in Michigan for Thanksgiving. A few days before my trip, Katie called to tell me Elliot had died. When she told me the news, I felt so sad. I felt sad for the relationship we never had, and more than anything for the pain I knew Katie was in. She was Elliot's favorite. And her grief was profound. He'd called Katie from a hotel suite to tell her he wasn't feeling well and that he was scared. And by the time she arrived to try to bring him to the hospital, he was gone. She lay next to him, wiped his brow, dressed him one last time. Arthur and I flew to Michigan for the funeral, using the tickets I'd bought weeks earlier in hopes of a reconciliation, never guessing I'd be going to bury him instead. I wanted to see him one last time, so when Arthur and I arrived at the funeral home, I went straight to the room where Elliot lay in his coffin. He looked the same, young for his age, full head of thick black hair. He was still with that awful woman. He still played tennis. He had never met my son. I touched his cold forehead and whispered a prayer of mourning. And then I took Arthur outside to the car. He was restless and fidgeting and wanting to nurse. Rock bottom. In June 2016, Jason, Arthur, and I traveled to Cancun as a family. We stayed in the presidential suite at the Hard Rock Cafe as part of a Father's Day promotion. Here is what Arthur, who was almost five at the time, remembers. He remembers seeing me eat toast with butter and a piece of fish. He remembers seeing an iguana. That's all he remembers. For this, I am eternally grateful. Here is what I remember. I was falling apart. The exhaustion and anxiety were destroying me. I couldn't hold it together, even for Arthur. I lost control and spent every stolen minute I could alone in our hotel room drinking. The last night of our trip, I fell over the sink and vomited three times, then lifted my head and searched for my eyes. My eyes. My eyes. My eyes. They were floating around in the mirror, detached from my face. "Why do you hate me so much?" I said to my own reflection. "You're fucking up, Blair. You're fucking up, you fuck up. You fuck up, you stupid fucking fuck up." And then I fell into the closet and reached for the bottle of tequila, the big gallon bottle I'd brought in from the huge bar in the living room that I'd hidden in my room. I unscrewed the metal cap and spilled the tequila on my face and down my throat. Then I collapsed on the bed and cried myself somewhere into oblivion. I don't remember much else from that week, except constant vomiting, running into walls and bruising myself from going to get more alcohol from the other room. It was a place I had never before been in my life, thus far, with responsibilities. A child. The pain I felt in Mexico. I could have been dead, and I wouldn't have known the difference. It was 4 days. It was the longest, most destructive binge I'd ever had. When we got to the airport to fly home, I was exhausted, dehydrated, hungover. I thought, if I can just get some rest, I'll be able to function as a mother again. I figured I would get some sleep en route, wake up alive again, and everything would be okay-ish. We boarded the plane, took our seats in first class. Jason, holding Arthur, was seated one row ahead of me. The man next to me ordered me a glass of wine. When it arrived, I drank it very fast, eager to get on with it, back to feeling livable. Then he asked me if I needed to sleep. I said I did. He offered me an Ambien, which I don't normally take, but I thought, oh, what's the difference? So I took it. I remember feeling agitated, kicking the seat in front of me, trying to irritate Jason. The next thing I remember is waking up in a hospital with an IV in my arm. Later, I found out there were nurses tending to me for the entire flight. Later, I found out I nearly died from dehydration and elevated blood pressure. Now I know I had MS symptoms that I was trying to self-medicate with booze, but at the time, I thought I was losing my mind. As all this was unfolding, Jason, petrified, continued holding Arthur, who miraculously was asleep with headphones on. He has never slept on a plane before or since. Jason didn't move, didn't react to the commotion, so as not to wake our sleeping child. Arthur slept through the entire flight. I will forever be grateful. The story was all over the news. CNN, The Daily Mail, People, TMZ, Refinery 29. A blurry photo of me, taken by another passenger, appeared in all the papers. Quotes from a witness popped up overnight. When I got out of the hospital, the paparazzi were all over the house, wildcats bored and hungry to humiliate. There is something unexpectedly freeing about public humiliation of this magnitude. It can't get any worse until it gets worse. It wasn't until Cancun that I saw how I had zero concept of how to take care of myself. Now I understood. I needed to make a change. With all things we see, this must come from within. I had never fully saturated myself in personal responsibility, but now I had Arthur. I had gotten drunk, beyond all control, in front of my son. The worst feeling of all was that he had witnessed it. I felt, for a mother, that was a lockup offense. My mother had taught me as much. Throughout my life, she remained a fearsome, strong figure, with full conviction that a child needed to have a sense of fear and boundaries in order to feel safe. Now I was putting fear in my son, but it was the opposite fear, the worry that I wouldn't be able to care for myself, even as a drunk who had done dangerous things to my own self. I would never put my son in danger. Knowing that my son, the person I created, that I am now responsible for, was present at a time when I lost all sense of myself. The clarity of that shook me to my core. Nothing truly tragic happened on that trip. It could have, and that was enough. That was the wake-up call. It knocked me out of Selma. It knocked me out of my own discomfort long